Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Liz Pelka reporting. President Trump said Sunday that he twice strongly pressed President Putin about Russia's meddling in last year's U.S. election. He said it's time to move on, as Mr. Putin vehemently denied the allegations. The comments came in on a string of Twitter posts in which Mr. Trump also said he and the Russian leader discussed forming a cyber security unit. One of the things the unit will address, election hacking. Some in the president's party already responding, like Senator Lindsey Graham.
It's not the dumbest idea I've ever heard, but it's pretty close.
Also, Senator Marco Rubio released a statement on Twitter comparing a partnership with Putin on cybersecurity to creating a, quote, chemical weapons unit with Bashar al-Assad of Syria. Iraq has declared victory over the Islamic State as its army fully retook the city of Mosul. Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi's office released a statement Sunday saying he has arrived in the liberated city and congratulated the fighters and people on the victory. Al-Abadi was seen in video greeting military personnel as service members danced in the streets and waved the Iraqi flag. Iraqi officials predicted the defeat of IS several times over the past week. A ceasefire deal for southern Syria has gone into effect. The de-escalation deal between government forces and rebel groups in the southwest began Sunday at noon. The agreement was announced Thursday after a meeting between President Trump and President Vladimir Putin of Russia. It is the first initiative by the Trump administration, in collaboration with Russia, to bring some stability to war-torn Syria. More on VOAnews.com. This is VOA News. As President Trump took to Twitter on Sunday morning, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said in Kyiv that Russian interference in the November election remains an impediment to better relations between the two countries.
The past, I don't know that we will ever come to an agreement, obviously, with our Russian counterparts on that. I think the important thing is, how do we assure this doesn't happen again?
Tillerson spoke alongside Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko after the two met to discuss ways to help end the conflict in the east. During his first official visit to Kyiv, Tillerson said that the U.S. has told Russia it must take the first steps to de-escalate violence in eastern Ukraine. Tillerson referred to the Minsk agreements in his talk with Poroshenko, a ceasefire deal that Moscow and Kyiv agreed to in 2015. He's appointed a special envoy to examine possibilities for jumpstarting implementation of the agreement. U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Nikki Haley said Sunday morning that the window for a diplomatic solution with North Korea was quickly closing following its test of an intercontinental ballistic missile.
We also think
the fact that they launched a ICBM test is hugely dangerous, not just for us, but for so many of our friends in the world.
Haley said on Face the Nation that the U.S. needs to put pressure on North Korea, as well as other nations, including China, who she says hasn't done enough to limit trade with the regime. The world's largest lithium-ion battery will be installed in South Australia under an agreement between the American firm Tesla, the French company Neoen, and the state government. From Sydney, VOA's Phil Mercer reports.
The 100-megawatt battery will put South Australia at the forefront of global energy storage technology, according to the authorities. They hope the project will stabilize a shaky electricity network, which suffered a statewide blackout last September. The system also couldn't cope with huge demand during a summer heatwave, and there were more power cuts. Jay Wetherill is the South Australian State Premier.
What it will do is completely transform the way in which renewable energy is stored and also stabilize the South Australian network, as well as putting downward pressure on prices.
The huge lithium battery is expected to be built by the end of the year. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Tesla says a project will produce enough electricity for 30,000 homes. I'm Liz Pelka, reporting in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
How a great Mugabe as a single individual can violate basic riparian rights for a massive, huge community. It just goes to show that the issue of property rights violation is basically a fallacy to ZANU-PF.
The Zimbabwean civil society and opposition groups condemn attempts by First Lady to acquire a state-owned dam.
So the young people in Mbarara were just presenting the views of so many young people and, of course, old people in the country. I do not really have a problem with young people exhibiting their displeasure.
The Ugandan police arrest three young men for conducting a mock funeral for President Yoweri Museveni.
The police could not give an explanation, just say that they've been ordered to stop any meeting in Chato. It is important to know that Chato is where President Magufuli originates, that is, own village.
And the Tanzanian main opposition party, Chadema, accuses the government for undermining the constitutional rights of its members. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The Zimbabwean civil society and opposition groups have condemned attempts by First Lady Grace Mugabe to acquire a state-owned Mazawi Dam in the Mashonaland province. The Mazawi Dam was the country's 16th largest reservoir and had a capacity of 39 million cubic meters of water. Local media report Sunday says acquisition of the dam will enable the First Lady to privatize the dam as part of a move to expand her business empire. The reports followed a recent court order ruling against the First Lady's attempt to seize a farm in the same Mashonaland province. For reaction about Mrs. Mugabe's alleged dam grabbing, I reached Zimbabwean political analyst Rejoice Ngwenya in the capital, Harare.
We will assume here that the independent story is a true and a correct reflection of the event in Mazowe, because that kind of event is just too good to be true. It is almost impossible to see how a Grace Mugabe as a single individual can violate basic riparian rights for a massive, huge community. It just goes to show that the issue of property rights violation, of redistributing resources to Zimbabweans, is basically a fallacy to ZANU-PF, because we all know the importance of that dam to the communities around Mazowe. And really, that should go out down as a constitutional violation for the people of Mazowe.
Some of her supporters are saying this is good because she wants to privatize it and Zimbabweans can enjoy it, and that this also forms part of her plan to build a university that will benefit all Zimbabweans.
As a liberal, I do not have a problem with privatization, but I have a problem when there is a contradiction. Because if ZANU-PF's policy of land distribution is about empowering communities, why is it that a single individual like Grace Mugabe can be given the right to violate the Water Act? Because ZINWA is the sole statutory body that controls water bodies. So I do not understand why it can be a good thing for the First Lady to take a property from the community, of even from a single or multiple white, commercial farmers, into her own being. So we are not talking about the benefits thereof. We are talking about the violation of property rights and the infringement of the community rights for the people that are around Mazowe. I think that's really despicable.
The IMF has issued a bleak assessment of Zimbabwe's economic situation and advised that the government spending on wages and agriculture are unsustainable. This comes as the government has unveiled plans to fund next year's budget during the agricultural season to the tune of $500 million.
Absolutely. It is very surprising that a government that actually has no money, with state coffers that are dry, basically they are struggling to pay their civil servants. The tobacco farmers who are involved in export growth, agricultural activities, could not be paid for their deliveries. So we are wondering where this government is getting this money from. Whoever they are borrowing the money from, maybe they are in they have liquidated treasury bills. So this is not the right time to be investing in that sort of project of agriculture. We are supposed to be investing in infrastructure and export-led growth. So it is very questionable. Zimbabweans should be asking questions why it is possible for Zanupian to raise that much money from the local market when industry is actually idle.
Rejoice Ingwenya is a Zimbabwean political analyst. He spoke with me from Harare. Sierra Leoneans go to the polls next year to choose a new president. Main opposition party, the Sierra Leone People's Party, or SLPP, seeks to wrestle power from the ruling All People's Congress, or APC. This, as President Enes Bai Koroma's final term expires in 2018. Seeking to lead the main opposition SLPP is Dr. Kande Yumkela, who faces a stiff challenge from Julius Maada Bio, a former military ruler. Dr. Yumkela joins me live in the VOA studios here in Washington. Good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon.
So tell me, what's your vision for Sierra Leone?
My vision for my country is to transform it to a very prosperous nation where people's rights are protected, social justice prevails, jobs for the youth, an economy that will be possibly a middle-income country in about 10, 15 years with good, sound macroeconomic management and fight corruption, the biggest problem in our country today.
Talking about corruption, politicians usually make, as you know, lofty promises during campaigns, but when they are successfully elected, some say they choke, become dictatorial, forget about the promises, the administration becomes bereft with endemic corruptions and financial malfeasance, among other ills. What would be different for you if Sierra Leoneans repose confidence in you?
You set the example yourself. You make sure you, as president, you declare your assets every 2 years in governance. Every 2 years, you declare your assets before you go in and while you're in. You set the tone which all your own public servants should follow, that they declare what they have and what they've acquired while they're there. Of course, we know their capital gains. You start with that. It is important. It's a litmus test. Second, accountability. The biggest business in African countries is the government. Contracts. In my country, it's 4 or 5 times the normal price, market rate for some of those contracts. And so you see a lot of leakages. I wrote an article back in September about institutionalized leakages, systems built just to fleece the system. The Auditor General says we lose about 100 billion every month in every year in our country, in our own currency. Yeah, it's not trivial when you look at the size of that economy. So you have to plug those leakages and ensure people deliver what they were hired to do.
So what about institutions act as checks and balances,
exactly,
to enforce laws of graft and to punish perpetrators?
Whistleblower protection. Empower the citizens. When you ask an individual or a ministry to build a hospital or a clean or a school or a road somewhere, let the people know upfront how much was allocated, who got it, and when they were supposed to deliver it, and at what quality. You yourself as president, and I've seen a couple of African presidents doing that, you begin to hold cabinet meetings in regions away from the capital, so that you can inspect those projects with the whole cabinet. That we promise these people will build a school. The school has been built. We promise them clean water. Here's where the project is. Accountability has to be there and performance. Mm-hmm. And I see in a number of African countries, we talk about allocation. Oh, government this year allocated X amount of the budget to education. We don't ask the next best question. What were the results? Mm-hmm. The institutions that I have worked in, both in the United States, in Europe now, at the UN, we have results-based management. It is not how much you put in alone. It is what did you deliver? Did you get value for money? Yeah. Did you get value for money? Mm-hmm. What were the results? And some of us have been used in these institutions to report results quarterly or every 6 months. You do the same with your ministers and public officials.
Now, you are aware that Sierra Leone has one of the highest unemployment rate among its youth.
Yes, sir.
Which is dangerous.
Dangerous.
Looking at how far Sierra Leone has come with its civil war not so distant past, what are you going to do to employ the youth?
Well, that worries me. It's about 60-70%. And I talked about that last week in a big press conference last Monday, a week ago, in my country. You know the response? The Minister of Information is sent out to just attack my person. This is reality. If you want to solve it, let's have a genuine discussion. 60-70% of our young people unemployed. People graduating from university. 3 years later, no jobs. What do you do? First of all, the type of education matters. We have so many of our youth graduating in peace and conflict studies. What is that going to do for you in life? We need them in other professions that makes them employable. Yeah. So the kind of education we're giving them has to make them employable. Second, we also have to encourage entrepreneurship. Government cannot employ people now. Can we help these kids when they come out of school, provided we've given them the basics, to start their own businesses?
Dr. Yonkela, hold your thought. Yeah. We're going to go for a break. And when we come back, we'll continue. That's Dr. Konde Yonkela seeking to become the presidential candidate for the main opposition, the Sierra Leone People's Party, SLPP. Join me live here in the VOA studios in Washington. Three young Ugandans have been arrested for conducting a mock funeral for longtime President Yoweri Museveni. Justice and Constitutional Affairs Minister and parliamentarians from the ruling National Resistance Movement, or NRM. The men were protesting alleged plans by the ruling party to amend the constitution to remove age limit to allow President Museveni to seek additional terms. Police say the detained men were in possession of a coffin with an inscription, "Rest in peace, Museveni." The arrest came after police refused to grant the men permission to protest. For reaction, I reached Matthias Mpuuga, a prominent opposition member of the Ugandan parliament in the capital, Kampala.
The arrests were uncalled for because Ugandans have the right, just like any other human being, to demonstrate in a manner that they believe will send a message clear to whoever attempts to violate their pact, which is the constitution. So the young people in Mbarara were just representing the views of so many young people and, of course, old people in the country. I do not really have a problem with the young people exhibiting their displeasure, but I, of course, abhor the arrest. They are just arrests made by overzealous police. If you ask them under what law they did the arrest, of course, they don't have a law. They don't have the law on their side. They're just being overzealous.
The news or report that the NRM members in parliament plan to come up with measure to amend the constitution, they said, is just mere rumor. What do you say to that?
First of all, the ruling party commands a forest majority in parliament. They actually believe the only thing they cannot do is to create a human being. Otherwise, it's the same group that amended the same constitution in 2005. These honorable gentlemen and ladies have no sense of shame. We all know that they think they're in parliament, not because they are very competent members, but because of the magnanimity of this strongman. He helped them come to parliament by rigging the last election. So they believe they owe him something in return for helping them allegedly for being in parliament. So I'll tell you, I work with them, I speak to them every day. Nothing will stop them at doing this heinous act against our constitution. I know they have been working on it. They have been meeting. I have spoken to those who have participated in these meetings. And I will tell you, they're trying to find a way of hiding it. Look as though that this was a popular demand of the people.
President Museveni is on record to have said that he is tired, he wants to go back to his village and to his farm and rest, and that people of Uganda unanimously are pressing on him to stay to steer the affairs of the country and improve the living conditions of Ugandans.
No, first of all, the president has never been on record to agree on what he has previously said. He's on record as saying some 10-20 years ago that the problem of Africa are leaders who overstay in power. So he's actually, in effect, indicting himself as one of the problems of Africa. But, answer your question directly, this gentleman never sticks to his word. I am not aware of any promise he has fulfilled without trying to change those he has promised. His love for power, his appetite for power is insatiable. So there's nothing the country can do to actually satisfy his love for power. Him and his clique have grabbed a little wealth. They believe the only way they can keep their grab is by holding on to power. They have literally appropriated the country. So they believe if they left power, they would probably be prosecuted for their transgressions against the state of Uganda. And nobody, at least not in my constituency, not to the people I speak to, have not had anybody beseeching this gentleman to stay.
Mathias Mpuuga is a prominent opposition member of the Ugandan parliament. He spoke with me from Kampala. The Tanzanian police have arrested over 50 members of the opposition party Chadema over a meeting in Chato. President John Magufuli recently issued an order banning all political campaign activities. The president says it is time for all Tanzanians to work hard instead of engaging in political activities. But critics say the ruling Chama cha Mapinduzi continues to organize political activities in spite of the ban. They accuse Magufuli of violating the country's constitution, which they said guarantees freedom of assembly and expression. John Malia, a leading legal team member of the opposition Chadema, told me the party would seek legal redress about the violation of the rights of the party members.
Well, it is not clear as to why they are arrested, but these are Chadema members and opposition party members. They were in an internal party meeting. When the meeting was going on, the police, full armed, entered the conference room. They locked the members inside and started tear gassing them. They tried to ask as to why you're breaking in our meeting, which is constitutionally allowed and legally allowed. The police could not give an explanation, just say that they're being ordered to stop any meeting in Chato. It is important to know that Chato is where President Magufuli originates, that is, home village. So opposition members in Chato get a lot of trouble at the time with the police when trying to conduct their normal political activities. And political life in Tanzania generally at a risk of being relinquished totally because the regime do not want opposition at all.
Officials of the police who wanted to remain anonymous because they were not in an official position to speak said that when they entered the hall, some of the Chadema members were unruly, became violent, and that is why the police reacted in that manner by, you know, throwing the tear gas to calm them down.
That is not the case. That's not true. The police are not allowed to enter into an internal meeting of what party members in your country. Internal meetings are strictly for members. If it were a public rally, it would understood that the police would be around and they're allowed to be around. But in this case, the police are the one who entered and start beating members, arresting people, and tear-gassing them. No Chadema member reacted violently against the police.
Is Chadema officially going to launch a protest? Because some members of your party are telling me this is a fundamental abuse of their right as guaranteed under the constitution.
Well, we intend to protest inside parliamentary meetings. We'll post a protest and ask for our right to be enshrined in this country. We'll also go to court. We'll file a case. Making sure, asking the court to order the government not to interfere with the political rights of people in Tanzania. The trend of suppressing opposition in this country has come as the regime of President Magufuli has started. We understand it does not like to be opposed in any way. He only wants to rule in himself, and that is not acceptable in our laws and our constitution. We're firmly going to protest in whichever means possible.
But President Magufuli said the time for campaigning is over. Now it's time to do the real work to improve the lives of Tanzanians. That is why there were announcements to ban political campaigns to allow people to actually work. What do you say to that?
I would say that is total misdirection of what he is intending. Politics is also work. The work of the opposition is always proposing, giving direction, giving opinion to the ruling party so as it can lead in a way that we think is correct and implement its manifestos in a way that is correct.
John Malia is a leading legal team member of the Tanzanian main opposition party, Chadema. He spoke with me from the commercial capital, Dar es Salaam. We return to the political situation in Sierra Leone, and joining me is Dr. Kande Yomkela. You were talking about the danger related to the high unemployment rate among the Sierra Leonean youth. What other plans do you have for them? Because, you know, they played a significant role in the country's civil war. They are idle. What are you going to do to help them out?
One of the things I will be doing now, I will not wait till I'm elected president.
Okay.
Yeah. Is to engage them in some youth dialogues now. Mm-hmm. In fact, I plan to hold a major youth conference in a few weeks, especially targeting the university youth and so on. We expect maybe 500 or 600 of them to really ask them also about their own solutions. What do they want to see government do? Yeah, I want to dispel this notion. You know, we have this cultist mentality in our governance that the power will do everything. The big man, you mm-hmm. know, he's a miracle worker. So first thing we're going to do over the next few weeks, again, is to re-engage. Second, as I said, you need special programs. Yeah, special programs on entrepreneurship, which means it has to be backed by cash. Kids who want to start their own business, we support them. But it's not only money. It is the entrepreneurship training. We have a good public administration college in our country to provide support, like an incubation mechanism, where they really help them with bookkeeping and so on. Some kind of a private sector extension service to help these kids start their own businesses. Number three, agribusiness is crucial. You know, still 60-70% of our population are in the rural areas. How do we make agriculture, so I talk about agribusiness, how do we make agribusiness attractive enough that these kids would want to start their own agribusinesses? And it has multiple benefits, you know, for the agriculture sector, but you're giving them a role they can play as entrepreneurs in food processing, food distribution, and so on.
Now, there has been an issue of ethnicity, of tribalism yeah. in Sierra Leone.
Yeah.
A lot of people that I have spoken with have mentioned the issue. It's permeated all sectors
yes.
of Sierra
yes.
Leone to yeah. an extent that even your political party yeah. has issues with it. Yeah. How do you intend to resolve this? Because it is a fundamental issue Sierra Leoneans have been expressing concern about yeah. for quite a while now.
And for me, that's the trend that bothers me over the last 10 years. I have seen that deepen. If there's any one single thing I underestimated in our politics, was the depth of ethno-regionalism. It is deep. And let me tell you why it is there. When politicians fail, when they fail, they don't have proposals about transformation, about change. When they don't want to debate domestic public policy, they go immediately to ethnicity. I am from this tribe. It is our turn to rule. Professor Lumumba has also talked about that. It is our turn. It is like a drug. It is fundamentalism. They then refuse to look at competence, ability to deliver, a track record. What do you bring to the table? Why should we entrust you with a country? It is not just because you are from our ethnic group. And so we have to preach against it. I am preaching against it openly because I say to them, the guy is super rich now and he had nothing before. To what extent did he help his tribe? They use tribe to hold on to power. They use tribe to keep good ideas from being debated or allowing the right people, meritocracy, to reign. So the right people are in the offices. The right people are leading governance. Yeah? And so it is deep. We have to talk about it. People like me have to look at people in their face to say, look.
You would have to come back so we continue this. Time is not on our side. Dr. Akande Yomkela seeks to become the presidential candidate for the main opposition, SLPP. He joined me live here in the VOA studios in Washington. This is The Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. In football, holders TP Mazembe of the DR Congo and South Africa's SuperSport United booked their place in the quarterfinals of the African Confederation Cup on Saturday with victories in their final Group D matches. Mazembe were 2-1 winners over Horaya of Guinea in Lubumbashi. To finish top of the standings, SuperSport defeated Gabon's Monana 4-1 in Pretoria to go through as group runners-up. On Friday, Club Africain of Tunisia and FUS Rabat of Morocco booked their place in the quarterfinals after a dramatic climax at Group A. Africain beat Kampala City Council Authority of Uganda 4-0 at home. Monabi Hadada scored twice, and Saba Khalifa and Motaz Zenzemi once for Group A leaders Africain. Also on Friday, FUS Rabat beat Rivers United of Nigeria 2-1 at home. Mohamed Fazer calmly converted a penalty 2 minutes from time as FUS finished level 9 points with KCCA, bringing the head-to-head rule into play. The Moroccans came second, having won 3-0 at home and lost 3-1 away to the Ugandans. Memoladi Algia of Algeria take a 1 point lead into Group B, a top of the table clash at record 3-time Confederation Cup winners CS Sfaxien of Tunisia. Meanwhile, Al Ahly of Egypt and Wydad Casablanca of Morocco secured their place in the African Champions League quarterfinals on Saturday as North African clubs prevailed in the final Group D matches. Wydad were 1-0 winners over 10-man Zanac of Zambia to move top of the group. With record 8-time champions Al Ahly beating Cameroon's Cotton Sport 3-1. That put Ahly 11 points with Zanaco, and with identical head-to-heads, Ahly went through above the Zambians on goal difference. Zanaco knew a point in Casablanca would have been enough to put them into the last eight, but they were thwarted by a 68th-minute goal from Wydad's Benchaki in front of the 80,000-capacity stadium. It was the first Champions League loss suffered by Zanaco this season and only the third goal they had conceded after 4 wins and 5 draws in qualifying and group matches. It now means 4 North African clubs have now reached the Champions League quarterfinals, with Esperance and Etoile du Sahel of Tunisia already through. The total could swell to 6 Sunday with the USM Alger of Algeria and Zamalek of Egypt looking to advance from Group B. There will also be at least 2 quarterfinalists from Southern Africa, defending champions Mamelodi Sundowns of South Africa and Ferroviari Beira of Mozambique, who went through after Al Hilal and Al Merrikh were disqualified following Sudan's global FIFA ban. Talking of the FIFA ban, football's world governing body FIFA banned Sudan because of government interference in the sport. The warning was issued last month after the government installed a new FA president. The suspension means that Sudan's 3 clubs in continental tournaments have been disqualified by the Confederation of African Football. Al Hilal and Al Merrikh have been barred from the Champions League, and Al Hilal obeyed from the Confederation Cup. Finally, in tennis, former champions Roger Federer and Novak Djokovic were in impressive form as they reached the 4th round at Wimbledon in straight sets. Third seed Federer played superbly in a 7-6, 6-4, 6-4 win over German 27 seed Mishka Zverev on center court. Djokovic, seeded second, had earlier looked fired up as he beat Latvia's Anis Gilbis 6-4, 6-1, 7-6. Federer will play Bulgaria's Grigor Dimitrov, and Djokovic faces Adrian Manarino in the last 16 on Monday. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports.
This girl is beautiful. She's beautiful.
And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent. Hold your one chameleon in a melody we call out.
We're more galanti. Kabichi, J'aurai de gros ennuis. cette situation, je ne trouve pas de solution. Car dans cette affaire, moi je ne sais plus que faire. Puis dans tous les cas, je n'ai pas tellement le choix. Si je dis oui, c'est imprudent à cause du patron. Mais si je dis non à la femme, elle va se venger.
Solo. Bona bana wolo sengae.
no me ayadie o mayape muna okusindutuwe kama suma ponda nde mabeni njomi monde mabeni njomi bona bana wolo senga e
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospects in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. For months now, an intriguing debate or controversy has been raging in South Africa, particularly among the political class. The political opponents of the ANC and the opponents of President Jacob Zuma within the ANC have been using the expression state capture to criticize the president and asking that he should resign on account of corruption. The argument is that the Gupta family, with extensive business interests in South Africa, has been exercising undue influence on the president, such as naming cabinet ministers. Perhaps in retaliation, those associated with the Gupta family, which is an Indian-born family, may have approached a British firm, Bell Pottinger, to develop another strategy to defend President Zuma. And Bell Pottinger came with the hashtag White Monopoly Capital. And that campaign has resonated among the grassroots in South Africa because they could see on a daily basis that even though political power was in the hands of the black majority, the economic power resides with the white minority. And this has now provoked accusation among the white minority that the firm Bell Pottinger has been promoting racism against South African whites. The leader of the firm has now apologized for his association with the campaign and has withdrawn. What is so surprising is that very few seem to understand the implication of accusing an Indian-born national or nationals of state capture in South Africa. Few seem to understand that Indians are a minority in South Africa, and they formed a major part of those who opposed the apartheid regime. Do not forget that it was an Indian lawyer, Gandhi, who first challenged apartheid system in South Africa. And when he got into difficulty, he had to move on to India, where he began the campaign against British colonialism in India. And it was the Indian government that first brought the idea of racial discrimination in South Africa to the international stage. The Indian government tabled in 1948 a resolution criticizing the discrimination against the black and black population in South Africa. And what happened then? Almost all the Western countries in the United Nations opposed the Indian government on the grounds that dealing with South African racism in the UN was against Article 2, Section 7, which said you should not interfere in the domestic affairs of government. How strange then that after independence and in the modern period, an Indian national should be accused of interfering in the government of South Africa. This is the strange situation. But all of this really is a shadow blow to real fighting in South Africa. Those who are opposed to Jacob Zuma at this stage are more concerned with the future leadership of the ANC, where his former wife is a leading contender. So these are the issues which should be at the forefront to see that both sides should not use ethnic arguments in their political fight about the next leadership of the ANC. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, Managing Editor Shaka Sali, reporter and producer Douglas Mpuga, our engineer for today, Tiang Wang, not forgetting our guest, Dr. Kande Yomkela and his team, who joined us live here in our studios. Thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, God is good, but never dance with a lion. I'm your host, Peter Clotte in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Every year, the United States Department of State issues its annual Trafficking in Persons Report, or TIP report, which evaluates the anti-trafficking efforts of 187 countries and territories, including the United States. The report measures government efforts in prosecuting traffickers, protecting victims, and preventing the crime. Human trafficking, also known as modern slavery, is a heinous crime that happens almost everywhere and affects virtually everyone. Today, more than 20 million people around the world are victims of human trafficking. Yet globally, governments report fewer than 15,000 prosecutions and 10,000 convictions. Human trafficking is as old as humankind. Regrettably, it's been with us for centuries and centuries. But in the expression of this act, as I read that one line to you, it is our hope that the 21st century will be the last century of human trafficking. And that's what we are all committed to, said Secretary of State Rex Tillerson at the report's launching ceremony on June 27th.
The consequences of our failure to act in this area has so many other negative impacts around the world. It breeds corruption. It undermines the rule of law. It erodes the core values that underpin a civil society. Transnational criminal networks also, whether they be drug dealers, money launderers, or document forgers, are partly enabled by participating in human trafficking activities as well.
In a letter opening this year's report, Secretary Tillerson said that this year's report focuses on the responsibility of all governments to criminalize human trafficking in all its forms and to prosecute offenders as outlined by the Palermo Protocol, an international treaty on transnational crime. Because trafficking in persons is a global scourge, the United States will partner with governments, civil society, law enforcement groups, and survivors to provide help for those who need our support. Secretary Tillerson also introduced the Program to End Modern Slavery, a new initiative that will increase funding for prosecution, protection, and prevention efforts to reduce the occurrence of modern slavery wherever it is most prevalent. The United States is a leader in the fight against human trafficking. We seek justice for victims and accountability for offenders, wrote Secretary Tillerson. We remain committed to the elimination of human trafficking here and abroad.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.